So hello and welcome to another Intrepid Times Private Writers Club Masterclass. I'm super excited to be speaking with an old friend of mine and a very accomplished travel writer, journalist, editor, Thomas Heaton. Thomas, welcome. It's great to have you on the program.
No, thank you very much. I do really appreciate it. Great to be speaking to you, Nathan, after a long time, across oceans and countries from New Zealand to all the way to Albania. It's amazing.
from a long way away. So just a lot of people on who part of the Intrepid Times community will be familiar with your work because you're one of our first writers several years ago. You've written a lot of pieces for us and your articles have been used, I think you know this, as teaching examples in a couple of occasions. We really enjoy your writing style and how you do it. Do you want to just give people like a brief overview of your career and travel writing and journalism?
Absolutely. More than happy to. My travel writing career, or my career in full, has been a bit of a journey from university onwards, really. So I graduated from the University of Otago, where I met yourself, Nathan. We both
represent.
We studied together in the South Island of New Zealand, of course, represent. It was there, actually, I did a degree looking at kind of getting into PR for some reason that is currently, as a journalist, unbeknownst to me. I decided to get into that. I don't really know why, but I did. So I did communications and I'd spent a year in Portugal before that. So I also did a diploma in language learning Portuguese. And after that, I realized that a Bachelor of Arts probably wasn't going to get me anywhere that I wanted to be, and decided to get into journalism. I thought that might help with this idea that I could eventually get into PR. But what happened was, when I did journalism, I realized that there was something in this course that spoke to me. There was something in this course that I felt that I wanted to do. So I went into journalism thinking it would be a good tool for me to get into communications and public relations. But what happened was, is I actually got into journalism. So I cut my teeth in local journalism in New Zealand, writing about cats up trees and writing about the local sports matches, whether it was rugby or football or, you know, that kind of thing. Then I got into social issues, which was a little bit closer to what I wanted to do, which was looking into immigration, the refugee kind of quotas and the refugee population in New Zealand. And later on, I got into food because I felt that food was a really good way of translating understanding in a language that everyone understands. It's the language everyone speaks. Food is the, you know, the one thing that unites us all. So I thought that was a great way to do things. So about 4 years into my journalism career, I found myself in Auckland, the biggest city in New Zealand, and I found myself unhappy for some reason, doing a job that I thought would make me extremely happy. And what had happened was, I think, is that I'd gotten so much into this kind of food form of journalism that I had completely detached myself from what was really the thing that I loved, which was people. And in an effort to seek that out, I actually joined the esteemed Nathan Thomas on a journey through China, fresh out of quitting my job in New Zealand. And we traveled around China for a couple of weeks. And the plan was for me after that to go to Nepal, as they say. And it's been there, actually, ever since that time that I've been working for the local newspaper, the Kathmandu Post, as a food and travel writer and as a editor. And one of my biggest roles there has actually been as a mentor for local journalists who have all the talent in the world as journalists, but they do need a helping hand when it comes to, you know, writing, when it comes to style, when it comes to ethics, as I'm sure many of our listeners right now will understand is something that, you know, everyone needs a freshener of every so often. But yeah, so that's where I've been posted for the last couple of years, and there's been plenty of travel within that. I've not been solely based in Nepal that whole time. I've traveled a lot through South Asia, and I was lucky enough also to travel across Europe as well. So my career has been, the foundation of my career has been in journalism. However, within that, I'd like to say that I'm kind of specializing in narrative, nonfiction, lots of profiling, lots of travel writing, and lots of writing about food, which is still one of my great passions, as well as travel. There is absolutely no doubt that my foundation in journalism has shaped the way that I write. You know, when I was going through journalism school, which was a very elementary training scheme, in New Zealand, journalism school is extremely elementary. They teach you how to write news. So what they teach you is you should write in an inverted pyramid structure. So you tell the reader everything at the start, and then you whittle down the details as you go. But over my experience from moving from local news journalism to more national journalism here in New Zealand, which of course is worth noting, our population is tiny and our problems are probably trivial by global standards, then going to Nepal, where automatically the population is 600% larger, I've kind of learnt how journalism is tailored to various aspects of audience. So that foundation, which started in very hard news, you know, car crash, someone dies, local government does something, then going national government does something, then later on in Nepal doing investigative stories which take months on end, I've been given this baseline kind of knowledge which has really informed the way that I write in terms of travel. But going back to the very start, there are some very basic things that we are taught as journalists, which is what makes news. So there are just a few kind of things that we are taught. You know, there's relevance, there's, in terms of newsworthiness, there's time and place, there's currency, there's various characters, there's someone's doing something out of the ordinary. And finally, I guess, other than those things, which I'm sure there are a couple of others that I've missed, one of those things is novelty. Or there's also other things of, you know, like someone famous doing something wrong, or someone breaking the law. All of those very, very basic things are the foundations of what, as journalists, we look for. But that has constituted the base of what I kind of look for as a travel writer, if that makes sense. And chief among them, I guess, is novelty for me as a travel writer. I actively seek out novelty. I look for things that aren't done. I look for things that I would want to read. I look for things that, you know, the Eiffel Tower is a wonderful place, don't get me wrong. But the chances of me going onto a place like, going onto a website like Intrepid Times and clicking on a story about the Eiffel Tower as opposed to someone literally in Timbuktu writing about their experience, I'm going to click on Timbuktu first. So that's kind of where I go. But then also that journalistic kind of baseline informs the way that I write, in the sense that I think this might have been discussed actually, Nathan, in your first class, was this idea of the first person. Is that I seek out experiences that don't require myself. Because I'm irrelevant as a journalist, if you look in any journalistic writing, any news, for instance, there's never an I in there. There is never a we. There is never an us. It's always about someone else. And I think that's what really informs the way that I write and the way that I seek out stories. I seek out things that I think other people would really value and be able to use without having to have me in the story, because no matter how accomplished I am as a journalist, unless I'm Anthony Bourdain or Bill Bryson or something like that, I don't matter. It's the reader who matters. And if you can get the reader to insert themselves into a story and you're just providing the lens for them, then I think that's the best way to go about it.
You seek out experiences that do not require yourself because you are irrelevant as a journalist. And you're right, that is something we spoke about a lot in the first masterclass. And it's something I think a lot of budding travel writers have trouble moving beyond the self. And it's something that we kind of articulated in the last masterclass, is that you can, this might be a difference between the kind of narrative travel writing that we do and kind of pure and hard journalism, which is that you can definitely write a travel story from yourself, from your perspective, and you can be part of the story without that story necessarily being about you.
Oh, absolutely. I totally agree. I mean, of course, with all of these things that I'm saying, all of these rules that I'm proclaiming, you know, that there are exceptions. There are always exceptions to these rules. But as a journalist, I honestly, I've had this conversation many a time with my own editors, is that I'm no one really. Until I ever get to, if I ever get to the status of Anthony Bourdain, sorry, he's going to end up being my touchstone here. But until or unless I get to that point, I'm never really going to insert myself unless, you know, as you talked about, it's the case of I find long lost ties to my own family heritage. There's some branch that has fallen off my family tree that I can somehow graft back on, I'm not going to be a part of it. Sure, I will use an I every so often to connect me to it or to connect the reader, more so to connect the reader. Otherwise, it's always going to be about trying to insert the reader into that experience, to guide them to have that experience. And I mean, at the end of the day, travel writing is about getting people traveling. So that's the end goal. A travelogue from, let's just say, New Delhi to Kathmandu or Bangkok to Yangon in Myanmar, day by day, I did this, we did this, the bus crashed, I felt bad, my belly wasn't nice. It's a Dear Diary kind of thing, and if anyone wants to read that kind of thing, I think that they can find that within their own diary, and that's a keepsake for themselves. But when you talk about my trip from Delhi to Kathmandu, my trip from Bangkok to Yangon, you just describe the experience, you immerse your reader in the experience, you tell them everything without you being in it, while you're, of course, in it, you're their lens, carries a whole lot more weight. And if you're able to keep the wording active, if you're able to say, you know, the bus chugging along, use lots of gerunds, lots of moving words, lots of ing words, then it's going to carry a lot more weight and people are going to be able to really immerse themselves in your writing. And I think that that's the most powerful way that someone can write. And I think also that that's something that, of course, Touchstone Bourdain was very good at doing. He was very good at saying, I'm in the middle of rural Vietnam right now, sipping on moonshine, not using I so much as that, but he was able to use metaphors and similes as touchstones to his audience, right? So he was able to say, this guy was as drunk as Elvis Presley at some night at the Playboy Mansion or something like that. He automatically brings them in. that's the familiarity brings them into the exotic, in inverted quotes. I think that's really powerful, that the way that he was able to do that, and I kind of aspire to that as well. But then that also brings me over to another point, I think, Nathan, is that there is relevance also in what I, with my journalistic background, kind of look for is, why do people want to read this? And going back to that first episode, that first seminar is, when do things become irrelevant? You know, is your experience 30 years ago relevant today? And especially, you know, during this time when everyone's locked down, I think it probably is. But how can you bring that experience 3 decades ago, how can you bring that to relevance now? And how can you tie it back? That's a question I actually have for you, is how can you make make things relevant?
That's a really good question. Okay, so whilst I meditate on that, I want to just draw a line for the benefit of the audience on two things that you've pointed out here that I think are really critically important. And one is that on the use of I, and members of this masterclass are going to hear us talk about that quite a bit, because it's a pet peeve as an editor that you see stories as littered with that. And it's not only a stylistic error, but it's fundamentally an error in how you're thinking about travel writing, and I would even say about how you experience traveling. And it can be easily corrected, and it's something I have to train myself out of when I started out writing professionally a lot of years ago. It's not something you're born with, an intuitive thing of knowing how to do, but transforming that and understanding the purpose of using I think it's just a major opportunity to evolve as a writer. Mm. And one thing you said that I think is crucially important is you said that you are the lens. You're using I to connect with the reader. So you're almost using yourself, not because you want to talk about you, not because you want to go, hey, look at me, how cool I am. You know, traveled from Bangkok to Yangon on an elephant's back whilst sipping tequila from a monk's hat. You're using it to give the reader an anchor, to be the lens, to use your expression, bring the reader in. I wonder if you could talk a bit more about the purposeful use of I and when it is appropriate to drop that first person pronoun into the prose and say, hey, this was me, I was doing that.
It's an interesting question as to when. For me, I guess, if I'm going to use I, if I'm ever going to refer to myself within the piece, I'm going to try and do it relatively early on, but as always, do it sparingly. There was one piece that I wrote for the Kathmandu Post, which I got a lot of praise for within the newsroom, which was, you know, very gratifying, very nice. But criticism, as always, is my favorite thing, because I'm not perfect and I know it, and I want to get as much criticism as possible because that's beneficial to me, more beneficial than someone patting me on the bum, you know. So what essentially happened was I wrote this piece entirely in the third person. It was about a monastery on the fringes of the Kathmandu Valley. Kathmandu, the capital of Nepal, is in a valley. This is apparently a monastery on the spot where one of Buddha's iterations or incarnations sacrificed himself to a tigress so that the tigress had enough metal to feed her cubs. Anyway, what happened was I wrote this story. I stayed in the monastery with the monks and I wrote this story about my experience. And just in one single line, I wrote something, blah, 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 M dash, as this writer saw it. And I didn't see it. It was a very flippant thing of me to do. And my direct editor kept it in. But my editor-in-chief came back to me and he said, really like the piece, Thomas, but that little snippet where you said, as this writer felt or as this writer saw it, detracted from everything, because I, as the reader, was there the whole time until you reminded me that I wasn't there because you wrote that you were there. So I think it has to be a very conscious decision whether you're going to be part of the story or not from the start. Before you start writing, you need to decide, am I important enough within this narrative to be in? For Shanta, the Rasta, something that I wrote for you about a place that I stayed in the south of Sri Lanka a couple of years ago now, it was literally me and Shanta. And I felt as though within that, there needed to be some relationship built between the both of us to actually draw out this man's nuance, to draw out this man's personality. So that's why I kind of added myself in quite early. But say if you're in a monastery, the place, you know, the subject of which story that I made a mistake and put myself into it, there are enough people and there's enough interest in that, within that kind of subject, that I'm not really needed. So I think one thing that you should really consider is, how important am I in telling the story of this subject? How important am I to this destination? And more times than not, I would gamble to say it's a firm no, you're not that important. Unless, of course, you know, as has been discussed, unless it's about you finding your long-lost home in a country that you lived in when you're a child, or your birthplace, or your family's family tree, or something like that. I think just a conscious decision, just being conscious about it when you're thinking about pitching the story, whether it's to Intrepid Times or elsewhere, how important are you? Because unless, as was said, unless you're one of the greatest writers out there who has a name for themselves, chances are it's probably going to be on the negative. But to go back to actually properly answer your question, Nathan, I think really when it comes to when you place yourself in the story, if you are going to place yourself in the story, I think do it early. Because if you do it late, then people will be shocked by it. They'll be part of the story by then. And then if they get reminded that they're not, then it all of a sudden becomes a little bit less enticing. And then if you're not going to put yourself in the story, just don't put yourself in there.
That's such valuable advice. And I really love the concrete takeaways people can grab from that. That is, decide at the start whether or not the story needs you to be in it. And if it does, put yourself in there purposefully and for example, as you did with Shanta the Rasta, which is a story people listening to this will be familiar with, because it was we've used it as an example of good travel writing before. And there you were there to establish the relationship between you and Shanta, which gave more insights, not into you, but into him, who was essentially the subject of the story. But if you're not important, make that decision from the start and then just leave yourself out of it. I want to also revisit another really useful thing you said earlier on, which was on the use of language. So you spoke about two pieces of advice there. And one is to use a lot of gerunds, a lot of active, moving, doing, running, jumping, drinking, laughing words. And the other was to use metaphors and similes in a very deliberate way so that you're connecting the exotic to the familiar, which is kind of providing a doorway for the reader to relate to the story. And I wonder if you can speak a bit more about that with your writer's hat, and I know you do a lot of editing and mentoring with your editor's hat as well.
So touching back on my journalistic training with the inverted pyramid, so give all the information at the start and give the finer details at the end. One thing that I was taught with my class was that only in the first line, so the first sentence, are you allowed to insert color. This was the worst. I absolutely hated it because I am naturally a colorful writer. I want to, you know, use nice words to make people feel things. So while I suffered through that for a few years, I was able to kind of keep going with it. And as part of that colourful writing, that first sentence was the only sentence that you're actually allowed to use anything other than the past tense. So if you look at news journalism, you'll notice the day was going really well until little Garfield found himself up a tree when he was eating his lasagna, only to find that he couldn't get down. So there's a sentence there that has a couple of gerunds in it. Old Garfield's eating his lasagna. But then after that, Fire Chief X said that it was a really difficult job. His ladder was broken, blah, 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 dry, 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 really black and white. And it gives you the information and it does so efficiently and it does so for a reason. But with travel writing, we're afforded this beautiful length of article where we're really able to just put people in a place. So as you might notice with a few of my stories in the Intrepid Times, I use a lot of those very active words because active words keep people reading. It's those active words that put people in the place. If I say, so Nathan, who I had met at university, went to Albania and found himself stuck there in a beautiful beach town during the pandemic. If I brought that to the present tense, I automatically throw them into a space that is current. Because no one wants to read old, especially in travel writing, unless it's some historical memoir. No one wants to read old. That's something I believe. So if I were to say, upon arriving into Albania, just a couple of days later, Nathan realizes that this idyllic beach town that he lives in is actually his home for the next who knows how long. He realized X, Y, and Z will happen or won't happen or might happen. So automatically you throw them, you throw your reader from, oh, this happened, so now it's irrelevant. You throw them into the present and into the future, and they start feeling things with the reader, sorry, with the writer. They really start feeling things. And that's something that I really feel is really important and something that I firmly believe in as a travel writer. Particularly as a food writer, the present tense is the most powerful tense. And with that, the present tense lends to the future. Going on to your second question there, Nathan. Using metaphors and similes, I mean, it's a very powerful and very convenient way of drawing in your audience. So within food writing, say, I could say that dumplings are a form of ravioli. So automatically people understand that these dumplings, which are meat wrapped in a dough wrapper, are ravioli, which is meat wrapped in a dough wrapper. But automatically, as a New Zealander or European or American, maybe it's a more familiar thing because it's Italian and you're comparing it to something else. What Anthony Bourdain does really well is he will take something completely out of the ordinary, something you would never have heard of. Say it's a one-eyed man with an eye patch in rural Vietnam. He will compare his drinking style to Hunter S. Thompson drinking whatever he drinks in the States. They're both shooting shotguns. They're both, you know, very cavalier with the way that they talk about things. Both are very sure about themselves. But automatically, Hunter S. Thompson is more familiar to you as a Westerner. And now you kind of understand a little bit more about who this person is. Perhaps they're in the stands somewhere and they're drinking some moonshine, and the writer compares one of the local barflies to Hemingway. He's supping on his cocktail just as Hemingway would with a green fairy or something like that. You know, having those kind of touchstones, reminding the reader that they aren't completely the foreigner within this kind of story that you're telling. It's a very good way of keeping them involved. And I mean, as a writer, your job is to get people to read you, and you don't want people to read your first sentence. You want people to read your last sentence. You want people to read the last word of your last sentence and think about it. So I think that the beauty of those things, going back to the dumpling ravioli thing, whether that's valid or not, you might think it's not, that's fine. But think about your audience. So when you're writing, you know, maybe compare, there's some long lost road to El Dorado that you compare to Route 66. Maybe it's the Hadrian's Wall, which is like a long lost version of China, of the Great Wall of China. Maybe it's, you know, some long forgotten island off the smattering of islands that is Japan, that you could compare to, I don't know, the Isle of Skye or something like that. There are certainly things that you need to think about when it comes to metaphors that apply to your audience. And that is something that actually goes back to pitching your stories to editors. And audience is a massive part of what we do as travel journalists.
Let's pick up that thread on the audience, because that's such a relevant thing, an awareness of who the audience is. And I think a lot of budding travel writers don't really ask themselves that. They're focused entirely on the story they want to tell. That's quite understandable. But as a journalist and an editor, you need to think about, well, who's actually going to be reading this? What's their level of awareness? Can you riff on that a bit?
If you want to be a travel writer, honestly, you have to think about your audience. Coming from my journalist kind of background, which I know I'm harping on about, I only have my job because I have an audience. Travel writers only have their jobs because there is an audience. So, to write without thinking about your audience is to shoot yourself in the foot. If you decide that I had this amazing experience in Sri Lanka, I'm going to write it as pure as possible without referencing or without acknowledging my audience, you're automatically ostracizing your very own your very own, you know, income source or your very own audience. So if I were to write about, well, let's go back to Shanta the Rasta. He automatically drew that line for me by putting himself within the cohort, the Rasta cohort. We spoke about Fat Freddy's Drop, a Kiwi band kind of Rasta music. By doing that, he automatically drew the line for me. Say if you're in the middle of Russia, maybe you can use a metaphor, you know, this hardcore $7 bottle of vodka that we were swigging like it was water made Kristoff seem like a 30-cent bottle of vodka. It made Smirnoff seem like the off-brand horrid drivel that it is. Perhaps you're in Czech Republic and you actually have Budvar. It's like, wow, this Budvar is actually really good. A far cry from the Budweiser that I'm used to in Chicago. Or maybe you're in New Orleans where you have some Cajun version of a French dish that you've had in France. Maybe you're writing for the French audience, so you use that kind of that French dish as the baseline for your explanation of what this Cajun dish might be. So it's all about thinking about your audience, drawing back, thinking about what might be the best comparison for the experience you're trying to give them. Just keeping that in mind all the way. Because if you don't keep linking back, then you're going to lose them and you're going to lose eyes, and eventually that's what's going to compromise your place or job as a travel journalist. And it's something that I'm always trying to think about. And I think it's something that if you haven't read Bourdain, then you need to, because he's very, very good at it. I mean, sometimes I feel like he does it a little bit too much, but God bless his soul, he's very good at it.
You asked me a little while ago, and I just want to confirm to you that I haven't forgotten this. What makes what makes a story relevant? And I want to come back to that. But before we do, I want to ask you something, which is, what makes a story a story? You've been traveling and you're just awash in experience. And then you're sitting down at your desk, and how do you know how to coalesce one piece of this experience into something that is interesting and relevant and that can be called a story? How do you know which piece of blade of grass to pick out?
It's a very good question. And I was actually talking to my brother earlier. I'm not sure if it's entirely relevant, but he kind of broke down the way that doctors kind of get their training. Is unconscious ignorance is how it starts, and then it becomes conscious ignorance. So people come to learn how much they don't know, and then you've got conscious understanding, so you understand how much you know, and then eventually you get to unconscious understanding. I'm not sure if it's a very good way of kind of saying at what point I am in my writing career. I feel like there is still a lot that I don't know, and there's still a lot that I want to learn. And of course, a clinical versus a creative kind of pursuit, they're very different. But I think there is some parallels that you can draw. There are some parallels you can draw. So right now, I think I'm kind of at the third rung. I'm conscious of how much I understand and very conscious of how much I don't. But also there are some things that I understand, but I unconsciously do them. So when it comes to finding a story, I think that's one of them. When it comes to deciding on what should be told, I think I'm at that point. But I think for people, when they are thinking about, you know, whether it was a trip they did a week ago or 3 years ago, I think they need to think about relevance and once again think about that audience. So let's go to Shanta the Rasta. Why did I choose Shanta? I initially chose Shanta because I thought he was just awesome. He was just this very novel personality. He was a Rasta, but he was living the life of a father with a wife and a single daughter. Why was he interesting? Because he had this, you know, history of being a Rasta, being a surfer. He smoked weed. He had this kind of party guy lifestyle back in the day. But then what happened? There was the tsunami that upended his livelihood. You know, as was said, he was up in a tree somewhere when it hit, because he had to be up there to survive. That automatically makes it, it adds the drama that you need. It adds the interest that you need to kind of make that story worth telling. Because I'm not sure that Shanta the Rasta would have been worth telling as much if it was Shanta the Rasta without the tsunami. So we all know that the tsunami killed thousands. It was horrible. And there's no taking away from that. But that kind of adds a touchstone for readers globally to be able to understand as being a momentous occasion that changed many people's lives. And to be able to humanize him, I think, was a pretty valuable way of kind of making it more relevant. So at the stage that at the time that I wrote it, I'm not sure actually how long after the tsunami it was, but I think that was a nice kind of touchstone. I mean, say if I were in Nepal writing a travel story, maybe I could tie it back to that point, or maybe I could tie it back to the civil war that happened 20, 30 years ago in Nepal. If I were in China, you could tie it back to another, you know, momentous time. I think it's all about really tying, you know, finding really big moments, tying it to them, or as a writer, actually just saying, like, this is why it should matter to you. Finding that point is really, really good when deciding. But then also it kind of comes back to, you know, as those kind of journalistic things are there when you're pitching stories, as you're told to, it's, you know, time and place, currency, characters. And Shanta kind of ticked the character. Well, he definitely ticked the character box, but, you know, time and place, currency, and also the novelty factor. I mean, I personally, when I travel, I want to do things people haven't done before, or I want to do things that not many people have done before. So that's why I traveled from Azerbaijan to Spain, overland essentially. That's why I traveled around Sri Lanka on a tuk-tuk. Because I also, if I can just say it, I'm not sure if it's really that relevant, but being able to travel over land is just so much better than flying. I would encourage every travel writer to do it. If you can bicycle across a country, do it. If you can unicycle, I've seen a guy just circumnavigated the globe on a unicycle, do it. Because when you're traveling over land, you're actually a part of the landscape. You're part of everything that's going on. And you're able to build relationships along the way rather than, you know, jumping on a plane and being thrown into another destination within just hours. So that's another thing I'd recommend.
Really hear what you're saying there. One thing I really like that you spoke about before, which is tying the individual character you meet, your own experience, with some bigger event. For example, you mentioned the tsunami in Sri Lanka or some historical event in China. One, I don't know if you had a chance to read, we only published it a couple of days ago at the time that this recording is being made, but the winning story from the Chance Encounters competition, written by Emma Dredge, it's called Coffee in Kigali. And she is a British traveler, and she was in Kigali, and she happened to share a table with a stranger, and she asked him about his life story, and quite cleverly coaxed out of him that he had been involved as a victim and also as a participant in the Rwandan genocide. And just getting that immediate human perspective is such a powerful way to create a story.
No, absolutely. I completely agree. I mean, you know, something like the Rwandan genocide is something that everyone should really know about. If anyone's been to school, they should really know about what happened there. It's likewise with, well, now it's kind of becoming a bit of a cliche, I guess, within Nepal, but, you know, there was the 2015 earthquake. That affected so, so many people. But, you know, there are these moments in time, there are these historical things that have happened, that have affected people, these kind of things that happen within, not within the travel writing sphere, but happen just within the news sphere, or they just happen within, you know, life. So there are these things that people know about. And if you give people that kind of thing, if you say, you know, if you give them a taste of something that they know about, there's automatically something that will tie them in, that will bring them into the story itself, which I think is extremely important, because that is, you know, going back, that is our job as travel journalists. We are supposed to deliver experience to people who either want to experience it for themselves or can't experience it for themselves. So, you know, being able to, I mean, how amazing would it be to write a travel story about meeting the tank man, the man who stood in front of a tank in Tiananmen Square? That would be the most incredible travel story, wouldn't it?
There's so much, like, absolute gold I think we've created out of this conversation, or that you've created, that people are really going to find relevant, that is just to see what makes a story interesting from a journalist's perspective, deliberately how to use language to engage people, to make it active, and also to relate the story to their experience. I loved what you said about when to put yourself in the story and to make that decision right from the start, and to do so only if it actually helps make the story more powerful, and how one way to know if a story is relevant or not is to connect an individual that you encounter overseas to a broader event. And of course, I completely agree with you on traveling over land wherever possible. I want to answer the question you asked me, which is what makes a story relevant, and everything you said is 100% true, and I can see it in a lot of the most successful pieces that we publish on the Travel Times. They follow the things you said there. Another thing is that there is a difference between, as I'm sure you know, there's a difference between journalism and travel writing. Publication like the Travel Times, we don't do hard news. You know, we don't exist to report this happened at this particular time. We allow people to connect to experience. And part of that is to inspire curiosity, to inform to a degree that it makes people want to learn more. And part of that is also just what moves you. If you're moved by something, if you're emotionally influenced by it, and then you want to go out, and you have that, you feel a connection to someone or somewhere that maybe you've never been before, you've never met.
No, I mean, yes, that's so true. It's I really appreciate that thought, is what moves you. What moves you is highly likely to move others. There's the piece in Intrepid Times, I think it's slightly earlier than the Ashanta the Rasta piece, we're talking about a man praying. He's kind of convulsing as he prays, you know. He's so into it. If you can translate an experience that moves you into an experience that moves others, if you have the ability to put that down into language that others can read, then that's the ultimate goal as a travel writer. I firmly believe that. There was a piece that I wrote, actually, for a magazine here in New Zealand. I had a bit of trouble getting it over the line at the start because it was actually about food in Nepal. And cuisine is very much a haute cuisine, you know, refined French gastronomy kind of foams and crispy bits and looks like a piece of impressionist art on the plate. But I ended up getting it over the line, only because I found the novelty in this cuisine that people didn't understand or didn't know about previously. But the way that I wrote the piece was I tied the start to the end, or the end to the start, which is a very common trick that lots of writers do, and I'd encourage others to do it, perhaps, as they go along. It's one trick, as well as kind of having a touchstone within the piece to reference. But it reminded me, actually, in that first seminar that you had, Nathan, I wrote this piece, and it was about this temple in Kathmandu, which is one of the biggest Buddhist temples in all of South Asia. And there was a man who stopped me, and he said, in broken English, No, you're going the wrong way. You have to go this way. And I must have resting bitch face, as the proverb goes, or something like that. But he felt the need to explain it. And he could see that I was in a rush. And he stopped me, and he spoke to me, and he said, No. This is just the way we do it. It's the little things in life that make the big difference. And I think also, looking back on it, while that was kind of the crux of my story as I wrote it, that is the crux of travel journalism or travel writing, is that it's the little things that matter. It's the little things that people will remember, and it's the little things you have to consider when you're writing, because those little things are the things that people are going to notice and they're going to take away and they will remember about what you write.
I hear that, man. Thank you so much. That's such a beautiful way to bring everything together. And I think on that note, it's an appropriate moment to say thank you so much for your time. Thank you for your insights. I'm so excited to get this piece of material out there. I think it's stuff that people will find hugely useful and valuable. We'll provide links to the stories that you mentioned on external platforms. I think that'll be really helpful for people who want to read more. I'm sure they will. And a link for people to check out more of your work with the Kathmandu Post as well. And I believe that wraps us up. Thank you so much, Tom.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.